you like listening to those ads you just heard? Well, I don't want to weigh in and tell you what to think, but a lot of people might not. Maybe you want to hear an ad-free version of The Gist. It is your lucky day. There is just a thing. Go to subscribe.mikepesca.com. It's Monday, December 16th, 2024. From Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Syria has fallen. Mortgage rates are touching 7% again. The FBI director is accepting a defenestration. And the number one issue in America is Cooter done seen some blinking lights in the sky. Sorry, it's in New Jersey. Big Petey and Little Petey, they're both seeing something and it's getting weird over here. But it's not just Cooter and Big or Little Petey or Medium Petey. Every elected official is now being made to answer for these lights in the sky. We want answers.
Do you think that this mixed messaging invites a credibility crisis for the government that could have a real impact on the American people?
Fox News Sunday hinting at the mixed messages. Well, one message is pretty straightforward. That's from the Pentagon.
There is not any truth to that. There is no Iranian ship off the coast of the United States, and there's no so-called mothership launching drones towards the United States.
But there's another from Congressman of New Jersey, Jeff Van Drew.
We know there's an Iranian drone ship that went missing from its port, and the timing of its disappearance is circumstantially consistent with the beginning of the appearance of these drones. These drones are reportedly the size of minivans. This is not the work of a backyard hobbyist. We know it is not a commercial entity.
But Van Drew alone, just Van Drew, engaged in mixed messaging himself because he prefaced that clear bit of alarmism with this.
Let me start by saying this. I'm not here to alarm anyone.
Too late, Jeff. And when the Secretary of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, went on This Week, he gave this answer.
We've deployed personnel, technology, and if there is any reason for concern, if we identify any foreign involvement or criminal activity, we will communicate with the American public accordingly. Right now, we are not aware of any. If we become aware of any, we will communicate accordingly.
If there's a reason and if we identify, we will communicate accordingly. So a double conditional triggering a promise to, quote, communicate accordingly, which might be to not communicate at all. That sucks. That sucks as an answer. I don't know if these drones are much of anything. They're probably just drones. But that answer makes me wonder if the Secretary of Homeland Security has been replaced by a pod person. It's probably responsible, but it's terribly indirect. What the American people want is terribly direct, but probably irresponsible, which is what Donald Trump gave them in a press conference today.
They know where it came from and where it went. And for some reason, they don't want to comment. And I think they'd be better off saying what it is. Our military knows and our president knows.
I have no idea if the next president knows that the current president knows. I know the next president and also once president. He is saying he does know that the president knows, but he's not saying what the president knows. You know who I trust on this one? Bernie Sanders. That guy, asked on Meet the Press, knew it was all kind of stupid. He was asked about the drones and said, I don't know anything. And then he was asked the tough follow-up question. Here's that exchange.
Are you concerned, though?
My concern, yeah, I guess, you know, I don't know. What can I tell you? Yes, I'm concerned.
Not exactly a crisis of concern, not a mothership of concern. But sure, if you need concern, I'll give you concern. I'm concerned. You happy? I'm concerned. On the show today, we concern ourselves once more with Isaac Saul and the news of the day. Isaac Saul founded Tangle in 2020, a news source deeply dedicated to covering events without a political slant. His business model definitely works, and Tangle has grown wildly in the last couple of years. So I invited Isaac back on the show to talk media and how to assess who is and was right on the biggest issues still in dispute, like immigration and inflation. Isaac Saul up next. I'm joined once more by Isaac Saul. He is the proprietor of Tangle, which has really become, to hundreds of thousands of readers, a valuable news source. It's a news about the news. It does two things. It summarizes the best arguments or most descriptive arguments and descriptions about news items. And then in the end, there's Isaac's take. And sometimes he outsources it to members of his team, which is a little bit of editorializing, a little bit of directionally telling you which of the arguments seem to hold more water. And sometimes he will just say the arguments on one side or the other side are deficient or inaccurate. And like I said, the proof of the pudding being in the taste, it has become invaluable to hundreds of thousands of people. Isaac, welcome back to The Gist.
Thanks for having me, Mike. Always glad to be here, man.
What I want to do is turn you into a pundit, which I know you're not.
Uh-oh.
But do the punditry as you do through the prism of news analysis, okay? And we'll talk topic to topic, and I'll tell you about things that I'm seeing in the news and how the news is portraying a couple of recent big stories. That sound good?
That sounds good, man. Right in my strike zone.
Yeah, I'll try. I'll try to give you the high heat. So one is, I came across an excellent article. I don't know that Tangle's written about it yet, but I came across an excellent article by David Leonhardt, cover of the New York Times, and they show that immigration during the Biden administration set a record. More immigrants than at any time in U.S. history, even during the great waves of immigration. And you're probably now saying, okay, that the country is, you know, two or three times bigger than the waves of immigration in the 19th century and the early 20th century. But even as a percentage of population, it ties with the most immigrants we ever had. Good facts, good analysis. He, Leonhardt, and the Times don't put their finger on the scale and tell you too much what to think about this. However, when you contrast this with the coverage of what the Biden administration had been doing on immigration, especially in the New York Times, it does seem to be a stark contradiction, because there were many, many stories about how now or late in the administration's tenure, they had gotten immigration to be far suppressed, that comparatively immigration wasn't like what it was at different times. So I was wondering if you had seen those articles. And I guess my big question is if you have any factual nitpicks, but when you have such a contradiction of past coverage, what does a single news outlet owe its readers?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, first of all, I think I watched as a lot of, you know, New York Times reporters and pundits who were on the left or center left made the case that Biden couldn't do anything on the immigration issue without Congress. They had articles that were framed that way in their Straight News division with quotes from Democrats and members of Congress and liberal-leaning sources, and they had tons of punditry like that in their opinion section. So when I read David Leonhardt's story about what was a genuinely historic wave of migration that we witnessed over the last 4 years, and then the way in which the Biden administration actually managed to restrict immigration in the last year and a half or 2 years of his administration, my question is, why didn't they talk about or report on the ways that he was able to do that via executive action before he actually did it? Because I think he proved pretty clearly that there were things on the table to do that he could have done earlier, but he chose not to for whatever reason. And maybe those reasons were, you know, high-minded reasons, like he wanted a little bit of a crisis to apply pressure on Republicans to come to the table for a big immigration bargain, which would have been a massive legislative achievement. Or maybe there was some real deficient policymaking that was happening inside the administration in the first couple of years where they just couldn't figure out how to fix the system until it was really becoming overwhelmed. And then they tried a few things late in his administration that ended up working. I think if you're the New York Times, an exploration of that, which is the kind of reporting, honestly, they're really good at, like the sort of what happened inside the castle reporting with 20 different sources explaining how the decision-making process went and where it failed. I mean, that'd be a piece that I'd be really interested in. And it's not an explanation that I've heard a clear response on from the Biden administration yet. So I don't know. That's the first thing that comes to mind for me is just like, we heard from them over and over again that they needed Republicans in order to do anything about this historic wave we saw in the first couple of years. They didn't get anything from Republicans. you know, Trump and Republicans tanked the bipartisan immigration legislation for, you know,
and that was
electoral
that
reasons.
Was their policy. When you ask Kamala Harris about it, their policy was to point out that Trump and the Republicans, some Republicans, tanked what would have been, you know, she was positing as the solution.
Right. And then at some point, it became such a political albatross around their neck that they were like, oh, shit, we actually have to do something about this. And then he put in a bunch of executive orders, tightened the restrictions on asylum, you know, started sending that kind of public signal, don't come. And that seemed to work pretty well. I mean, a lot of the numbers we've seen the last year are actually much better than people thought they would be at this point in his administration. So I'd be really curious to see a piece like that. And I think, yeah, I think the New York Times does owe its readers, based on how it covered the migration crisis early on, an explanation of, you know, what they got wrong about the assumptions on what Biden could do, and also what happened on the inside, why the decision-making process was the way it was.
Right. So they put out, and the magazine Tablet pointed this out and did a juxtaposition. On October 30th, they had a video opinion piece, and the title was, "If You Think Biden and Harris Were Weak on the Border, Think Again." And it mostly talked about recent changes that where the border was tightening and fewer people were coming in, which is true. But context is very important. And compare that headline, "They're not weak on the border," to what Leonhardt just showed. It was an historic number and degree of migration, quite clearly in contrast to the reasonable person. And I guess my question is, should the Times, A, get credit for getting it right? Should they be criticized for the timing? It'll be very hard for critics of the Times or Democrats not to say they withheld this analysis and coverage until after the election, right? Should they get criticism for that? Is that fair? Or should they be complimented for eventually owning their mistakes? Or are they even owning it enough? You could have both pieces of information out there. And if you don't directly say we did get it wrong at times, how much credit should you get?
Yeah, look, I think the important thing here on there are two ways I think about the timing of this piece. The first way is it's the end of Biden's administration. I mean, he's going to be out of office in a month. And this is a good time to do the retrospective on his administration. So I think, you know, A, setting in mile markers about where we are as a country right now, I think is really important. So in 4 years, we can compare where we are now to where we are at the end of Trump's term. I think we should do that. And it's important to compare where we were now to where we were at the beginning of Biden's term. The issue with the timing, my criticism of it, is, again, this is coming after a year of relative, you know, success on reducing the migration crisis at the border. This piece should have been in the Times 2 years ago. It should have been in the Times a year ago. I mean, that was when we were really in the peak migration crisis, when I think we weren't really seeing headlines like the largest immigration surge in U.S. history. The, you know, the kind of cynical way to view that is it's election season and the Times didn't want to publish damaging stuff about Joe Biden. I don't think that's necessarily true. I think the Times publishes damaging stuff about Democrats all the time. I think maybe a more realistic view is there's just a lack of curiosity or a lack of interest in reporting on this stuff if you're at the New York Times, because it was so central to the kind of right-wing conservative media ecosystem that's such big critics of places like the Times. It's almost like you don't want to affirm or be on the same side as the people who like hate and criticize you.
Negative polarization is a giant driver in politics. And you're saying, and I agree, it's also a big driver in media.
There's a lot of ego and a lot of, you know, personal, interpersonal drama at all of these media organizations between each other and inside them.
Yeah. And a lot of wariness of being scorched by your audience and saying, what are you, a Fox News outlet?
Right. And this is what, I mean, I'd be curious. I read the David Leonhardt article. I don't know. Do you have any temperature check on what the reaction to it has been? Are Times readers upset or reacting in a negative way to them publishing this? Because I don't have a good read on that.
Yeah, no, I didn't see comments on the article. And mostly I saw people on the right or center right saying, now you tell us, New York Times.
Right.
But I also want to be fair that we both paid a lot of attention to news on immigration for years, and it is not the case that mainstream media outlets ignored the fact that there were records being set at the border. And for a year, Alejandro Mayorkas would go on the Sunday shows and get grilled by Margaret Brennan or George Stephanopoulos. You know, why are these records being set at the border? So it's not as if no one accounted for it, but the Times is really important, and the general drumbeat of coverage was more of, now the administration is tightening up. There was a problem, but, you know, things aren't as dire as perhaps you've heard. And I don't know if the Leonhardt article would indicate dire, but the numbers were the numbers. And I didn't get the impression as a Times reader that the numbers were as stark as they are.
Yeah. I mean, I think the another big kind of takeaway for me is just It's a reminder that the sort of response that we saw from Americans during this election season to debates like the ones around migration, they were not based in some sort of like mystical xenophobia being fueled entirely by the right-wing media ecosystem and Elon Musk and Donald Trump. And, you know, the way that argument was sort of framed a lot by people in the center or on the left was that, you know, there are a bunch of people who are willing to vote for a President Donald Trump because they're being indoctrinated by people like Elon Musk into thinking that there's some major crisis that doesn't actually exist, when now we're getting this historical accounting from the paper of record saying, oh no, the thing that people were feeling was actually tied to a very real thing that was happening. Of course, Elon Musk and Donald Trump were inducing kinds of xenophobia throughout the election season. I think that's obvious, self-evidently true. But I also think the reason the country was so receptive to that, and the part of the reason Donald Trump won, you know, immigration has and is always going to be the one single core issue he seems to be consistent on, is that this thing was really happening and people were feeling it, not just in El Paso and, you know, Eagle Pass, but in New York and Chicago and Denver and Seattle. I mean, it happened all across the country, and it happened because there was a record wave of migration here, which is a destabilizing social thing, whether we want to, you know, whether we like that reality or not, it's true. So I appreciate them publishing this piece. I think that there is something about it that feels like, oh, great. Now, you know, a month after the election, we're talking about this in a more realistic way. But yeah, it was historic and it mattered.
Yeah, my take on the election was, well, there were a lot of personalities involved, and I understand that the temperature of the world was anti-incumbent, very much so. But there were three big issues that motivated voters, four, including abortion. Democrats clearly owned the abortion issue, but the other three were immigration, inflation, and crime. Now, on crime, I think it's been abated greatly since then. And actually, crime came up as a talking point among Republicans, but it didn't seem to be the breakout issue of the election. It was immigration and inflation. And I do think that these were real problems that not just Democrats, but the mainstream media minimized. And they definitely minimized the Biden administration's and Democrats' role in creating the problems. What have you done? What has Tangle done on inflation that either rebuts or supports my thesis that Democrats and the choices they made with how they funded the Inflation Reduction Act and other spending acts, that their choices directly affected to the number one problem that Americans, you know, voted on in the election?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think there's a great deal of economic evidence that the spending that came at the end of Trump's administration, for what it's worth, and early on in Biden's administration was, you know, accountable for roughly 40 to 50% of the inflationary effect that we saw, you know, in the first 2 or 3 years of the Biden administration. The numbers and the way that, you know, people study this is so complex and so complicated. I'm not an economist, so I trust people like the Chicago Fed and, you know, people have PhDs in macroeconomics and study this stuff for a living. And there seems to be a pretty good consensus that that's what happened. Very good writers, even on the left, people like Noah Smith have written about this and have explained that, you know, part of this was tied to things like supply chain shock and people saving money during the pandemic and then the kind of post-pandemic coming back to life of the economy. And a lot of it was tied directly to the spending that we did and basically overshooting on the fiscal response to the pandemic, understanding, you know, that there was a risk it would cause inflation, but trying to take lessons from the 2008 financial crisis that we didn't want to do less and let the country spin out into a great recession. So they made a choice. I think it was a really difficult choice, and Biden was dealt a really shitty hand, and they did the best they could. I mean, but it happened. And then I think this kind of second part, the political part of it, is like, we heard, at least in the beginning, I mean, it seems like a fever dream now because it was before the assassination attempt and before Biden had his debate performance and all this stuff, but they were going to come out and run on Bidenomics. That was their instinct in the beginning of the Biden campaign, was to come out and tell voters that the economy was actually doing well. Look at GDP growth, look at, you know, unemployment rates, look at these kind of traditional macroeconomic things that we point to. And Biden wanted to be a candidate who ran on his economic record. And they debuted this for like 3 weeks, and he toured the country, went to North Carolina, went to Pennsylvania, and he was talking about Bidenomics. It was all in the headlines. And the response was so like aghast and it, like, how could they be this out of touch, that they pulled back from it, and then they kind of reset and they sort of pivoted, and then Trump named J.D. Vance and all this stuff happened, and we all kind of moved on. And by the time the actual campaign was up in earnest and he picked Kamala Harris, you know, they were running on abortion and the threat to democracy, which I don't think was a terrible idea. But the reality was there were a lot of indicators that people were struggling. There was massive credit card debt. There were people, you know, tons of statistics about people being late on paying rent. Housing costs were, you know, hugely inflated in major cities all across the country. All these kind of, I guess, less traditional metrics for how we measure the economy, showing that people were actually really, really struggling.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a lot of accountability for that. And there wasn't a lot of understanding of it. And I think that mattered.
Okay, so let's go back to a couple things. Trump and Biden both have passed huge stimulus packages, but the order mattered. So during the, and it wasn't Trump who passed it, it was Congress who passed it. During that round of stimulus was needed, I think almost all the economists say. And then when Biden did pass an additional third round of $1.9 trillion relief, there was a lot of thought. Larry Summers raised it, and Jason Furman raised it, that this was overstimulating the economy. There wasn't the output gap that would be that you would want to see to justify such stimulus. Okay, so that's part one. I do think both stimulated the economy a lot, but the Trump administration or that era, the stimulation was warranted. And during the Biden administration, that round of stimulus was unwarranted and it did cause inflation. Now, you'll get a lot of pushback from that. So you cited Noah Smith, who's left, center left, you know, I'm sure I know the real lefty economists, or even the not so very lefty Brunig type economists, would disagree with that. There are still plenty of economists who say it really wasn't the stimulus. Peter Orszag, who's a prominent economist, argued this in a big article in the Washington Post. I could cite other kind of household name economists among the households who know economists. So what do you do? How do you just... Then you also cited the Chicago Fed and others. How do you figure out what the consensus is? And as a non-expert, do you just say, well, the votes line up, 60% of the economists say this, 40% say that? Or do you put in effort to discern if Peter Orszag's arguments seem more logical than Jason Furman's arguments?
Yeah, so a couple of things. I try not to tell people what to think. And so, you know, my job is to share all those different arguments that exist out there in the economic space, in the punditry space, from people who I think are reliable, well-studied experts on this issue. And I want to give my readers the opportunity to make that choice. When it comes down to writing my take, where I sort of try and call balls and strikes and share my personal perspective, what I tend to do is rely on the people that have sort of guided me well in the past. So I'm reading all these experts, not just in any given week, but over the course of years, you know, especially now I've been writing Tangle for 5.5 years. So I'm familiar with a lot of the names. People like Larry Summers have earned my trust because they've gotten a lot of stuff right. So, you know, when I see him publish something in the Washington Post that's like a big warning sign about, you know, what he's seeing that's concerning. And he's also doing it about his own team, which always adds a little bit of credibility in my mind. I mean, I like when people do that, when they criticize the folks in their tribe. That gets my attention. And because of his record on a lot of this stuff, it makes me think that he's more reliable than maybe somebody I'm less familiar with or somebody who I've seen get a lot of stuff wrong. I think Noah Smith is, you know, traditionally been a pretty accurate pundit. He's kind of a generalist in a lot of ways and covers a lot of stuff. But I read his newsletter when it shows up in my inbox, and I read his Bloomberg columns. And, you know, I think he's been pretty bang on about a lot of really big political issues in our country. And so I tend to trust him a little bit more when he's, you know, talking about what's going to happen in the future, trying to analyze what's happened in the past. I'm limited, you know, I'm not an AI algorithm, so I can only take in so much information and process so much information. But generally speaking, I try to remember and take note of the people who appear to have a pretty good record on these issues. And you know, it's hard. It's hard to listen to or trust someone like Paul Krugman or something like that, who I've seen be wrong about some really important stuff over the years, and just like take what he says as gospel. So, you know, I tend to think that there seems, from all the content that I've consumed about this and all the punditry and the Fed reports that have been released and all this stuff, that there's a pretty healthy consensus that, you know, this stimulus certainly didn't do nothing, right? We know that it had an impact. The degree to which, whether it was 20% of inflation or 60% of inflation is kind of where the debate is. But, you know, we have a government in office who is responsible for that stimulus package, for a big part of it. And many Republicans, as you mentioned, who got on board and supported it and voted for it, too. So I think there's plenty of criticism to go around.
We'll be back with more from Isaac Saul in just a minute. We're back now, talking with the Tangle founder and CEO, Isaac Saul. In evaluating which economists to trust, which were right, one of the things you do is you look at the track record. I also index for if they were predicting a specific outcome beforehand and that prediction came true, I retroactively give them a lot of credit. Usually, the people who rebut that sort of heuristic as in asking was the person right and correct will always say, well, there were other exogenous factors that made the person correct. But I tend to say, if you say X is going to happen and then X happens in the precise manner you said it, you get credit. And then there's the, like you, I'm reading what they're really saying and I'm reading them quoted in the popular press, mostly not in economic texts. And there are, here, I'll read you some quotes from an article in USA Today, which was written months ago, you know, who's to blame for inflation? And they quoted a bunch of economists, and I think they do give a decent impression about answering the question, who's to blame? But they quoted a few economists who said it mostly wasn't Biden-Harris. And they quoted Mark Zandi, who maybe he's one of those guys where you could say, oh, he has credibility because he served as a McCain advisor. But I think since then, he's been mostly a Democrat advisor and left-leaning. That's fine. But he writes, there's a long list of reasons for the high inflation. The Biden-Harris policies that are on the list are at the very bottom. I'm not sure exactly what he means by that and how many he would list. But I do think the consensus, here's what I'm getting at. The consensus is the biggest factor was, of course, the pandemic. And a second huge factor was the war in Ukraine. And maybe the third biggest factor was the stimulus. So he seems to be defending the Biden-Harris record, but either through a clever quote or how he was quoted is not rebutting anyone who said the basic premise that the stimulus greatly contributed to inflation. I'll read you another quote. I'm going to ask you about this. Jeffrey Frankel, a Harvard University economist, said, Biden-Harris don't bear primary blame for the inflation. Primary blame rather goes to supply constraints as the economy came out of COVID and the acceleration of commodity prices that came with Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But even the people who are blaming Biden-Harris would not disagree with that. So when I read that quote, and what do when you read that quote? Do you say he's playing a linguistic game? Do you say maybe he gave a quote that to USA Today that he didn't really realize that he seemed to be evading the question of blame. How do you process a statement like that?
Yeah, well, first of all, like putting my critic hat on, I would just say, if you want to say the number two issue related to this inflation was the invasion of Ukraine, you could also lay that at the Biden-Harris administration's feet. I mean, there's a pretty good argument from conservatives, especially, that, you know, we didn't see Putin go into Ukraine when Donald Trump was president.
Well, that's that's one where I don't think it was the Biden administration's fault. I thought that they were more serious about it than even the Ukrainians. But go ahead.
Right. But and I'm saying there's issues with that criticism. But you know, it's like the invasion of Ukraine that destabilized these global markets was also something that happened in an era when, you know, the United States was being run by the Biden-Harris administration, who are kind of playing police chief of the world. So, generally speaking, though, I would say, I think it's fair to add some gray, and I don't think this issue is black and white. I mean, there's no world in which the kind of inflation that we saw and the way it sort of paralleled with this rather strong economic recovery that we experienced, where we did have low jobless rates, where we did have good GDP, where we did onshore some manufacturing jobs. There's no way that all those things happening at the same time can be explained by one or two issues. I mean, it has to be a confluence of events. But we also have to figure out like what we're going to learn from it from a policy perspective. And those people saying that, okay, this was the third most important thing that happened that drove inflation up. To me, it's like, okay, well, this is like a really important number three that we have actual tangible control over in the future. So let's talk about number three and then talk about how we should address it, what we learned from it, what we should do differently next time. Because even if it's 20% of inflation or, you know, however you want to kind of measure it, that's still a pretty big deal. And it makes a huge difference in the lives of Americans and the economy more broadly. And so I'm happy to concede that the pandemic was once in a lifetime and the return from the post-pandemic world was unlike anything we'd ever experienced. I'm happy to concede that the war in Ukraine destabilized global energy prices, which makes everything get more expensive. But we had control of this other thing. So like, let's talk about how to do it differently and how we should address it the next time this happens, because there will be a next time.
In fact, I would go further and say that government policy, federal policy, is only ever at best the third most important reason for anything, right?
Yeah,
crime.
That's a good
Why
point.
Is there crime? One, because of guns. Two, because of the situation of desperate people who resort to crime. And then three, the actual government policies of interdiction. You know, war in Ukraine wasn't U.S. federal policy. It was Putin's incentives and Ukraine's incentives. And then maybe down the list is Biden policy. You know, that's an interesting dodge. You know, it was at best the third most important thing. When you're talking about the full weight of the federal government, the third most important thing could have a huge impact.
Yeah, totally. I think it's a really good sort of 30,000 foot framework to work from. And you know, and yeah, the war in Ukraine is honestly a great example too, to kind of buttress that point. It's just like Putin invaded Ukraine because he believes Ukraine belongs to Russia, and nothing the Biden administration or the Trump administration could have done would have changed that. He's been very clear about that. I think he was going to do it eventually regardless. And unfortunately it happened. Unfortunately for Biden, it happened when he was in office, but, you know, there are things on the margins maybe the federal government or U.S. foreign policy could have done differently that maybe change outcomes there, or even, you know, they just respond immediately by arming Ukraine to the teeth like they are right now from the very start, and the whole contour of the war looks different. But hindsight's 2020, and, you know, we didn't want to get involved super early on and we wanted to be measured and all this stuff. So, like, let's learn from that and take it to the next time something like this happens. But yeah, I generally do very much agree with you that the impact of federal policy, especially on economic issues, is often really, really overstated.
You know what? I'm working on a thesis here in real time. With everything we've been talking about so far, the most important thing just might have been COVID. I mean, it was certainly with inflation, with crime rates, the rise of crime rates, the reaction post-COVID was also certainly a factor. And even with the invasion of Ukraine, you know, reportedly Putin got a little crazy and isolated during COVID and then came out strong during it. Yeah. And what can you do about COVID? I don't know. You ask the Wuhan lab, they might say something. I want to talk about one thing. As we're talking about economics and how people were feeling pain, and you talk about debt and you talk about other economic indicators, you even said some of the less traditional economic indicators. Okay, how fair is it to use these less traditional economic indicators? I don't want to shut down the possibility that if you look at this chart, if you look at, I saw a really good one that Bankrate put out of inflation as index. They start off with inflation and wages at index of 100, and then they track it over time during the Biden administration. It still hasn't caught up back to 100. Inflation has been outpacing wages and outpacing the amount that was lost, even though wages have caught up. But to do that, you're not using unemployment. You're not using traditional measures of wages. How fair is that? I remember when Trump was running, they had, I think, kind of crazy thesis about we don't look at the economic indicators we've always looked at that seem good for the incumbents, right? Only look at things like workforce participation, or don't look here, look there, and only look at the indicators that are bad. So are there rules of thumb around this? How do you at Tangle navigate which different economic indicators are legitimate and which are being cherry-picked to paint a picture?
So I think, first of all, the general traditional economic numbers we use are important to reference because we've been using them for so long that they're a good way to compare current administrations to past ones. So if we just change the way we're measuring it, it makes it harder to talk about, you know, what it was like in the third year of Biden's term versus the third year of Trump's term. And so we're going to keep using GDP and unemployment and all this stuff till the end of time because it allows us to kind of put things in a historical context. And I think that's fine. I do think there are issues with it, you know, something like job growth, you know, if the federal government's just creating government jobs with a bunch of funding and stimulus, then maybe those numbers are kind of less important. I generally have had a bone to pick about this for a very long time. I've written about this, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, even before I started Tangle, that I do think we should be using different numbers to measure the kind of like economic health of the country. Because, you know, Apple having a massive explosion of production and sales that drives up, you know, the stock market and the United States GDP doesn't necessarily impact me all that much as a person or tell me a lot about kind of how my life is going. To steal somebody else's work here just for a minute, I mean, I thought Annie Lowry from The Atlantic wrote one of the best pieces about this that I saw. She had the headline of the piece was "The Cost of Living Crisis Explains Everything." And she had this one paragraph in the piece that I thought really kind of encapsulated this well. She lists all the things, you know, all the ways Democrats have talked about how the economy was going well. And then she said, during the Biden-Harris years, more granular data pointed to considerable strain. Real median household income fell relative to its pre-COVID peak. The poverty rate ticked up, as did the jobless rate. The number of Americans spending more than 30% of their income on rent climbed. The delinquency rate on credit cards surged, as did the share of families struggling to afford enough nutritious food, as did the rate of homelessness. And then she talked a bit about mortgage rates and the cost of housing, car payments, you know, what a family purchasing a $400,000 apartment with a 20% down payment would pay today, $2,500 versus $1,800 3 years ago. I think those are really, really important numbers that explain the economic sentiment being divorced from, you know, gross GDP and the jobless numbers. So I think we need to make that kind of stuff a really important part of the picture and talk about those numbers more and measure them more now. And one of the things I'm planning to do before the year is out is take stock of where a lot of those numbers are in the final days of the Biden administration and then set a calendar reminder for myself in 2 and 4 years to kind of see where we're at in the Trump administration, because I think that'll be pretty important.
Isaac Saul is the proprietor of Tangle. Go to readtangle.com. It is an excellent and useful resource. Hundreds of thousands subscribe and read and benefit from the fairness that is shot through in all the Tangle products. Isaac, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Mike. Huge fan of the show. Always glad to be here, man.
That's it for today's show. The show is produced by the Quaint Mallards. Corey Warr is the producer and Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Michelle Pesca spearheads special projects for us at Peachfish. To advertise, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Oompuru-gee-puru-doo-puru, and thanks for listening.